Radio.
I'm always jumping the gun. This is Wayne Young, publisher of Port of Harlem Magazine, and you're listening to Port of Harlem Talk Radio. And I'm here today for our second episode ever with Dr. Ida Jones and Sandra Schoberg. And we're here to talk about the finding of the movie Nation Time, Gary, which was a film on the 1972 National Black Political Convention. And first of all, let me introduce Dr. Jones. She's the University Archivist at Morgan State University and author of four biographies, including Baltimore Civil Rights Leader Victorian Adams and The Power of the Ballot. And in 2018, she conducted a program for Port of Harlem called How to Preserve Your Legacy. Sandra Schoberg is a long-term advocate of off-Hollywood filmmakers. She currently serves on the advisory committee of the Women's Film Preservation Fund and is a member of the Association of Moving Image Archivists. As a producer, she has many film credits or films to her credit. Nation Time Gary, as I said, is about the 1972 National Black Political Convention at my alma mater, Gary West High Senior High School. The original 90-minute cut was never released. And in 2018, it was found in the Pittsburgh warehouse and restored with funding from actress Jane Fonda and the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. Lastly, what I found interesting was that the film was done by William Greaves, who created more than 200 documentaries and had four Emmy nominations. He was also the co-host and executive producer of Black Journal before it became Tony Brown's Black Journal. So, Sandra, getting first to you. Generally speaking, what happened to the film from the time he shot it in 1972 to when it was found recently in a dusty warehouse before your group restored it?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for inviting me on to talk about Nation Time. This is one of the great lost treasures of, I think, American history, certainly of the history of the Black power movement in America. And Bill Greaves, whom I knew, was an extraordinary filmmaker. You mentioned his four Emmy nominations. He also won an Emmy. He was one of the most prolific. He was one of the most prolific American documentary filmmakers, you know, in American history. And his work stands, you know, shoulder to shoulder with other great American documentary filmmakers. I think it's important also to note that Bill, who was born and raised in Harlem, you know, left the United States because he didn't feel he could make his way here. And he went to Canada, where he worked his way up, but he ultimately became a director at the National Film Board of Canada and made some extraordinary films there before deciding in the 60s that he really had to and wanted to come back to America, precisely because he wanted to play a critical role in, you know, in the civil rights movement and documenting the civil rights movement. So he returned to New York, and he based himself in New York for the rest of his life. He died in 2014. And I think people are going to rediscover the work of Bill Greaves. I hope they are. I'm glad you have. I'm so glad you have. He's really an amazing filmmaker. And I think they're partly going to rediscover his work because, thanks to Kino Lorber, an excellent distribution company, Nation Time is going to be released nationwide on October 23. But also, we are working with curators at the a major theater in New York City, the Brooklyn Academy of Music Cinemas, to mount a full-fledged retrospective of Bill's work. And Columbia University Press is going to be bringing out, at about the same time, a book about Bill Greaves. So I think he's finally going to get the, you know, the recognition that he deserved.
And you're going to make sure when those things are released that Port of Harlem knows about them.
Absolutely.
So that we can let our readers know.
Yeah, I think it would be great if you keep following what's going to happen with Bill and with Nation Time in particular. So we found, just to go back and answer your question, Bill and Louise Greaves, who were married, you know, for 60 years, they often used, for many, many, many of their films, they used a laboratory in Pittsburgh called WRS. It was cheaper than the major independent film lab in New York City, which was Duart Film Laboratory. But because Bill and Louise were always struggling for money to make their films, they did rely on WRS in Pittsburgh. The lab, as so many laboratories have done in the past decade, the lab went bankrupt in 2001 because, as you know, I'm sure, people stopped making films on film, that is, on celluloid, in the 90s and certainly by 2000, and by 2013, the theaters all went digital. And
no, I never thought about
therefore,
that.
Yeah, this was a huge transformation. And therefore, films that were on film, that were shot on film, if they were no longer, they were no longer accessible. They can't be shown anymore. That's true. They can only be shown in, you know, museums like the Museum of Modern Art or at the Academy Film Archive in Los Angeles or certain theaters that still pride themselves on being able to project film on film, like the Film Forum in New York City, the Metrograph. I'm sure there are theaters, one or two, in your area that still might be able to show film. But by and large, films across the country now in America are only shown in a digital format. So here's the good news about film. Film, especially film negative, is made on film stock, on celluloid stock, that is remarkably resistant. Of course, it survives best if it goes straight into cold storage and is kept in cold storage. But what we discovered when we went into the wreckage of this famous film laboratory, WRS, we found an unholy mess. I mean, film cans stacked on top of film cans stacked on top of film cans, 70 pallets of film cans wrapped in plastic that has been tearing away for decades with a leaky roof, rain falling on the film cans, mold.
Okay,
I mean,
so once
you couldn't.
Can you tell me, though, Sandra, once you got there, how did you all find that particular one? Did you go through all of those canisters or what?
No, we have still not. All you can do is you can try to walk through. There are really no alleyways. All you can do is, like, walk around these pallets and see, looking through the plastic, some of the labels are still legible. Most of them are not because of the rain and the condensation. But this Pittsburgh archivist, Emily Davis, I give her all the credit. She works at Carnegie Mellon. Somehow, in this haystack, she found all 10 reels of Nation Time. I don't know how she did it. And it also was a miracle that all 10 were together in the same stack. But she found it. And by the time we got there in February of 2018, because she had made one or two visits to the warehouse before we got there, she had spied it out. And she knew we were looking for Bill's work, among other people's, because Bill and Louise, who's Bill's widow, told me that they use the lab. So the good news is she found it. It was a total miracle. But, of course, we didn't know what condition it would be in, because that meant it had been sitting in this wet warehouse since 2001. And before that, because the film was made in 1972 and processed at WRS in 72, it sat for 40 years 30-some years in the lab before the lab shut down, and then it was moved to this warehouse where it's
okay,
got,
well,
let
me ask Ida this a typical story, because, Ida, this reminds me so much of Oscar Micheaux's film being found in Tyler, Texas. How common is this for Black history to be lost?
Well, it's not just exclusively Black history, but I think it's also when people don't have a plan for when a company goes belly up. So when someone is a company or corporation, they do active work, and they don't have a plan in place, that becomes a problem because they're really trying to, quote, save their skin. Unfortunately, there is a proclivity towards African-American culture as well as some Asian culture. Actually, Chinese culture in New York, they had a similar kind of fate, because unless they're in conscious effort by the individuals who were using the service and or the service itself to bequeath or secretly donate their materials, it would not be done. We had a situation here in Washington, D.C. with a funeral home on Florida Avenue that went out of business and or relocated, and they made a conscious effort to contact Howard University to deposit those records at Howard University. So once again, the business thought of its own self, even though it ceased to exist as a viable business, even in its kind of post-life, that it would exist in an archival space. So it would take that conscious effort of the company, corporation, and or affiliates or boosters of the corporation to say, okay, let's put these things somewhere.
Okay, great.
Well, I think, Ida, you're so right, Ida. This is, and when it's a commercial company and it's going out of business, and what WRS did, and this is, again, where independents and especially African-American filmmakers are left high and dry, they turn around to the studios and they say, we're shutting down in a week. Here's what we have of yours. If you want it, come and get it now. And in fact, the studios were given warning when WS closed, and they did pull out 8 negatives by the director, Otto Preminger, and a great deal of other material. But the lab did not have the time or the will, frankly, to contact the thousands of other indie filmmakers, and in this case, you know, very important filmmaker, Black filmmaker Bill Greaves, to warn them, come and get your film. And we know that with a Pittsburgh filmmaker, very famous Pittsburgh filmmaker named Tony Buba, who makes films about his hometown of Braddock, that Tony knew he had a film of his there, and the lab owner made him pay, and basically held the film hostage and made him pay $3,000 to get his film out, to take his film out. So that's the kind of thing that also happens in situations like this. But mostly hear about it until it's too late.
Okay, so I know actually about Louise Greaves, the widow, and how she supervised the restoration. I understand she was joined by their sons, David and Donald, who had worked on the film. And also you had the help of the archives at the Schomburg. So how was the process of working with so many people and keeping this baby alive?
Well, first of all, we brought it back to New York, and our film specialist inspected all the reels. Louise came to the office to see for herself that we had it. She was so thrilled. And we discovered that the film was not in as bad condition as you might expect. I mean, yes, there was warping and shrinkage, which is typical for a film that old, but it was in remarkably good condition, as we discovered. Considering, it still was a very challenging restoration project. Louise was the one who, once we had scanned the entire film and synchronized the sound, and we were able to do a first pass on the color grading, the color correction process, it was Louise who stood in for Bill and commented on every scene, every sequence in the movie, and worked with our colorist to try to achieve the best possible version of the film. And there was a tremendous, it was with a tremendous sense of relief that we could see that we could bring it back to life. on the other hand, because of the lighting conditions that Bill was dealing with, and his son David was his assistant cameraman, and his brother Donald was the sound man on it, they were up against very challenging conditions because they were basically in a school auditorium. It's not a film studio. It's not a situation where you control the lighting, where you control the sound. There were thousands of people there. They had a really, really hard time shooting it. And you can see all of that in the negative. I mean, we could see all that. So balancing the color from one scene to another was very, very difficult. And ultimately, Louise made the decision, because there were certain things about the film that we didn't feel we could really fix, she decided that she wanted to have us make a version in black and white where the shifts in color that Bill was not able to control would be less obvious, that they wouldn't be distracting. And so we actually we took the color out, and we were then looking at an extraordinary black and white film, and that's what we chose to premiere at the Museum of Modern Art. The world premiere of the 90-minute version was shown in January of this year at the Museum of Modern Art.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I saw a black and white. You kept mentioning color. I kept thinking, I swear I saw a black and white version, but okay. I saw a black and white
you
version.
You did. You did. Okay. You did. But the original version was color. And, of course, we made clear in the program, the MoMA program, that this was the black and white version of an original color version, that we were still working on the color version. And that's what we did. We went back in and we worked for weeks and months longer on the color version to try to address the things that were still bothering us and bothering Louise. And naturally, by this time, people were starting to hear about the film and everyone wanted to see the color version. So we finally feel as though we got the color version to the point where it deserves to be shown publicly. And it's the color version that is going to be premiered on October 23, when the film starts its national theatrical run. Yeah, so
that
we're very
will be
excited
different because,
about that.
Because in many ways, I did like the black and white because it made me feel like I was back at that point. But I wasn't too sure if color was the standard back then or not. But can you also speak about the role of the Schomburg and their archives?
Yes.
And then hopefully Ida can talk about what they do.
Yes. Over the years, Bill and Louise donated a tremendous amount of material to the Schomburg Center. I mean, Bill felt very strongly about that because, as I said, he was born and raised in Harlem, and he really wanted his paper archives and his motion picture archives to be held there. So over the years, before Bill's death and then after Bill's death, Louise made another huge, the library acquired another huge volume of material from Louise. So the collection, the Greaves collection, the majority of it is now at the New York Public Library's Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture. And the head of the film archive there is Sharla Lynch, who's a wonderful, wonderful woman, friend and colleague, who is personally passionate, I'm happy to say, about the work of Bill Greaves. And she's now working to restore some of his other films, which also can't be seen in a high-quality digital format until they go through the same process that we went through with Nation Time.
Oh, right. So I guess, Ida, that sounds familiar to what you do at Morgan State. Is that correct?
Yes, because the 20th century is rapidly becoming a memory for a lot of people, and I guess a new kingdom for those millennials, that the post-World War II and or the post-Korean War is becoming a very hot space to really analyze history. Historians do not consider anything history unless it's 50 years or older. So anything younger than 50 we would call political science and or sociology. So historians now are having a keen eye to be able to investigate and interrogate individuals who participated in activities in the late 50s, 60s, and the early 70s. So in light of the political rise of the mayor of Gary, Indiana, as Wayne has so clearly always reminded me about, that black political power really becomes one of the prisms of light that are refracted out of the civil rights movement of the 1960s. And we could even look at the civil rights movement of the 1930s. So what we see in the 1960s, 1970s is the rise to power as being mayors across the country, to holding elected offices for the first time, even in Washington, D.C., having home rule in 1973 and having the chance to elect their own mayor. So this piece of video is extremely crucial because in a generation prior to, there was acetate film, and then there was the other kinds of film that had the vinegar syndrome that would, of course, explode, they found out. So the other idea that this film survived, even in the poor climate in which it was kept, and there are places like we have here in the D.C. area, Color Labs, that will go and take an analog film that's on reel and digitize it. We actually have some video footage at Morgan that was able to be viewed. It was kept in the same lovely metal tin that is prone to oxidizing, which will cause rust and warping of the film with the humidity, because film is a very sensitive medium. But surprisingly enough, those kind of World War II era steel canisters really are very durable. But ideally, you would want to have them in a cold storage space and to have them in a much more stable environment so there's no corruption of the film. Mm-hmm. So I'm very excited to hear that Shola is at the Schomburg, because she actually, I believe, is a filmmaker herself. And so that actually helps when you have that personal interest and passion. And I really can see this particular work becoming the standard bearer of the next 15 years in the 21st century because of the fact, even though it is the 70s, it's not that long ago, but to a generation of people who are now 20 and 25 years old soon, that's a time before they were born. So it's very foreign. So it's very important for us to connect our current events with that very recent history.
That's what I was saying earlier to Sandra offline, that I thought the film was bittersweet because in many ways you see how far we have gone. So one of the things they mentioned is that they wanted a quarter. They said blacks were one of every five Democratic votes, and they wanted 25% or 20% of the Democratic seats. Well, blacks almost make up a good percentage of the U.S. Democratic Congress now. And you've had a black president of the Democrat and a black woman who's the vice president nominee. So in many ways, what those folks dreamed about in 1972 is happening.
And it's so
recent.
No, I think it's very interesting because to the young people who are born, let's say, in 1995 coming forward, that is their normal. So they don't see the kind of vicious ways in which things are being eroded in a kind of morphing fashion, that white supremacy as well as voter suppression and other kinds of activities to disfranchise people is morphed from the idea of Bull Connor and the fire hoses we saw in Eyes on the Prize. Or for those of us who had to watch it, of course, in Eyes on the Prize because we weren't alive during the 1960s. So they think this is normal. So they really don't have an understanding of the longer arc of how recent these acquisitions are, even in terms of the franchise, suffrage amendment, 100 years old, the 50th Amendment, 150 years old. So when you look at countries like Italy and Greece that have things that are 800 and 1,000 years old, 100 years is very recent. So and to see the erosion of these things is very critical.
I understand your point, and I agree with that 100%. But I'm saying out of this film, I got almost the opposite feeling, and that I saw how much things have changed, and that I saw them talking about having 13 black congresspeople and how they were excited about having 13. I think you have about 50 now.
Yeah,
they were thinking about having a black person running for president.
In some of those states, too. I can see what you're saying, but the Congressional Black Caucus is also going to be formed. And then some of these organizations we now hold up as being great things were fraught with some of the fracture of the time. There was great sexism in the CBC during its origins, and there was great issue of colorism and other kinds of issues in the CBC. So even though we can say we've made great progress, on one level, but there's some internal issues that need to kind of be brought to the surface and excised from the space.
Oh, I agree with that 100%. But I tell you, while watching this film, I felt bittersweet. In good many ways, I felt good because I saw progress. In many ways, I saw what you're speaking of, Isla, that I didn't see progress because some things still were unresolved.
Yeah, I think when I see the film, I also feel bittersweet. I feel this tremendous sense of, you know, coming together from both ends of the political spectrum and every point in between, coming together to try to forge, you know, a national Black unity platform in advance of the conventions, the Republican and Democratic conventions, in advance of the elections. Shirley Chisholm is not invited and also declines to come because she's not getting, I mean, Ida, I love the fact you mentioned the sexism because that was there, very much there. Although
you have
Betty Shabazz and Coretta Scott King at the convention and in very prominent, you know, positions, and you have Queen Moore, and it's some very powerful women there. But
I feel they only I think they only show that Coretta Scott King didn't speak, and Betty Shabazz only introduced Jesse Jackson,
yeah.
I believe.
Jesse Jackson. That's right. You're absolutely right. But then the other
they were seen but not seen.
Yeah, in a way, you're absolutely right. And the Jesse's speech, which is so powerful, I mean, where I say bittersweet because it also reminds you that some of these very same issues, most of them, are still problems today. So, yes, many, many, many more elected officials, Black elected officials, and a Black president and now a VP candidate, but still, in a way, so far still to go. And that's why
I think
the film is going to resonate today.
Yeah, there's something about film that is rather powerful. I mean, that pretty much makes the modern civil rights movement, or any kind of visual image. So you go from Emmett Till and his casket that Mamie Till had in Jet Magazine, and then now you go to the newscasting in the 1960s, and you're seeing people being shot down with fire hoses for doing basically nothing, just simply trying to walk.
Yeah.
So it becomes a situation in which the visual image really does speak to the visceral aspects of our humanity. And because our generation is very visual, everyone has to do PowerPoints now. We can't listen to lectures anymore. There's got to be some kind of whistle and sizzle with everything, that I think this film and seeing familiar faces, such as, you know, a Betty Shabazz or Coretta Scott King, these people we hold in great value. And some of the other ones, Vaughn Troy and other people who are in Congressional Black Caucus, to see them in kind of a very different light in terms of our new modern post-gender, post-fluid, all this other stuff we do now. It's very recent acquisitions. And so that'll be something to see what the young people think about that critically.
Now, I do think Richard Hatcher, as he makes an incredible speech about, I think it's a wonderful ode, really, to Richard Hatcher, who just died a few months ago. We were so sad that we didn't get to show him the film before he died. He was such a powerful and important figure, and his inviting everybody to Gary was a historic act. So there's a lot of
because his film exists, so he still is with us in a kind of celluloid fashion, not in a literal fashion, but he does speak.
Well, we almost have about a minute and a half to go, but I wanted to ask Sandra too. There's an award, a $25,000 grant, I should say, or an award or grant, being offered by, and let me call his name, Stanley Nelson and the Firelight Media. And how did
that
come
right.
about?
They,
the $25,000
documenting
projects and mentoring.
Yes, Stanley was. I think he feels that he was mentored by Bill Greaves. Bill was also just a wonderful teacher and an extremely kind man, and he took such an interest in other people and other filmmakers in particular. So Stanley decided to form this fund in Bill's honor, and he announced it at Sundance in January. You know, this was just before the shutdown.
Okay,
Stanley
we only have 30 more seconds.
To our premiere.
So let me tell you, we only got 30 more seconds before our next guest, and he's here. But can you tell us how will people contact whomever to find out about this $25,000?
If you just grant. Google Bill Greaves Fund Firelight, you'll get all of the guidelines for applying for the grant. And yes, it's an important grant for filmmakers making documentary films, and it's a pretty significant amount of money. So I don't want to try to explain the details of the guidelines, but they're pretty straightforward.
Please don't. People would need to go online to get it, and we'll try to also include it in Port of Harlem Magazine and on our Facebook page. But let me go to our next guest. But I do want to thank both of you all for your time and for such an enlightening conversation, and for even bringing all the attention of the film to my attention, and for Ida for adding to it. So thank both of you, Sandra and Ida. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Talk to you. Thank you all. Take care now.
Good
bye
night.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, coming up next, we got Melvin Foote. Melvin, are you there?
I'm here. How are you?
Pretty good. So I'm glad you're here, because we wanted to switch to our next conversation with you. As many people might know, that the lead article in the last Port of Harlem magazine was an article you had written for another magazine, actually, and we excerpted it. But first, let me introduce you to people who may not have read the article, may not be familiar with you. And that is, Melvin is president of one of the surviving African advocacy groups in America, and it's called Constituency for Africa, or CSA. Melvin is a Rockville, Illinois native, has more than 35 years of experience, and has worked in over 30 African countries. The Constituency for Africa has established a network of organizations, groups, and individuals committed to the progress and empowerment of Africa and African people worldwide, and he helps shape a progressive U.S. policy towards Africa. And so, Melvin, before we get into the conversation, I just want to tell you that I do remember the days of Trans-Africa, and I understand they existed from 1977 to 2015. I remember they had a very nice building off of DuPont Circle. I can tell you there were some very nice parties there, but they're no longer here. So how did your organization remain intact?
Well, you know, first of all, everything changes. That's one thing that one has to realize. Nothing is remained the same, and the strategies have to change, and the people have to adapt. CFA is we're now, you know, over 30 years old as an organization, and you know, that's no easy task. And people say, "How did you do it?" When some of the bigger organizations, AFRICARE, is on the ropes, and Trans-Africa was a multi-million dollar in stature, and Washington Office on Africa, and Black Professional International Affairs, Africa Action. There was a whole slew of them when I came to Washington, and it was almost like a turf. You know, everybody had their turf, and the question was who's the biggest and, you know, who's the baddest, and Africa had a $40 million plus budget a year.
No, I remember that, because they even belonged to another one that was focused on Blacks in the Latin countries. But go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, CFA was founded at AFRICARE. I was with AFRICARE for many years, and I was brought back from Somalia, actually. I was a country director in Somalia. AFRICARE brought me back to help educate Americans about Africa and to educate people about AFRICARE's mission, which was, you know, rural development, agriculture, water, healthcare, forestry, and that sort of thing. So my strategy was to try to link up all of the Black organizations that work on Africa, regardless of what their mission is. Trans-Africa was a policy group. Africa did rural development. Others did other education and other things. So I said, regardless of what you do, we all need to have a link between us that we can share information. We could network, we could build camaraderie and that kind of thing, and that was the Constituency for Africa. And so CFA was founded as a project of AFRICARE in 1990, and, you know, the main mission was to build a link between us. And so a lot of my activities involved organizing meetings, and I would even step out of the meeting. So whenever there were decisions made or anything, I didn't have to be involved in the decision-making. I had to be more involved in the process of bringing us together. I felt that was just an overwhelming need. And so CFA really got started as a networking organization between all of these organizations that work on Africa.
Oh, makes sense. So then when others did something else, you did something else to remain intact. Is there anything in particular you could think of that you all did or you did so that you still exist?
Yeah. Well, CFA actually got, you know, pushed out of Africa. Africa felt that CFA was taking up too much oxygen. You know, we were getting a lot of articles in the newspaper, magazines, on TV and all that kind of thing, and it became kind of like controversial. So I was asked to really separate CFA from Africa in 1994. It happened in April 1994, the same month that Nelson Mandela got his independence. That's when I got my independence. So CFA's mission is to educate the public about Africa, improve cooperation and coordination between the organizations that work on Africa, and then we work to help shape U.S. policy toward Africa. So why is CFA still here and the others are not? Partly because CFA is a speedboat and we're not a battleship. Africa was a battleship. Trans-Africa was a battleship. The National Council of Negro Women, battleship. These are all battleships, big, robust, powerful organizations. Some of them had buildings. They had endowments. They had all these relationships with corporations and so forth. CFA had none of that. And so CFA is around today because our footprint, you know, we're a small organization with a big footprint. We have a very small budget, always have struggled for resources. And so on the one hand, you know, you say you need resources to survive. You do. But on the other hand, if you're totally dependent on, say, U.S. government support, a lot of Africa's money came from U.S. government support. And others came from different, you know, corporations and so forth that felt they had to do something about Africa because of the dictates. But when the winds of change came about, U.S. government decided they no longer was going to fund Washington, D.C. organizations. They were going to fund directly in Africa. Africa did not read this tea leaf. And they kept expecting this USAID money going to continue to flow, and it didn't flow. It just stopped. And so that was their problem. And others have, really they were dependent on the largest of donors and that kind of thing. Well, when the donors change their priorities or when the donors stop giving, there goes the organization. Well, CFA didn't have those problems because we never had money. And
gotcha.
On the one hand, I need money. I desperately need money to do some of the things I need to do. But, you know, at the same time, when we don't have money, like we haven't really had money for the last year, all throughout this coronavirus period. But we're doing some of our best programming now. You know, Zoom and electronic communication is perfect for what we do. That way I don't have to pay for an airline ticket. I don't have to pay for meeting space. I don't have to pay for, all the things that cost a lot of money. I'm not paying for it. At the same time, I can reach larger audiences. I got people in Africa coming to my meetings. I got African heads of state involved. I could do a lot of those things on Zoom, you know. And so I've always embraced technology and others didn't. I am, you know, when the fax machine first came about, I was the fax king in Washington. Whereas others took the reticent approach like they wanted to be the big man or the big this and what, have this showboat attitude. I took the attitude of less is more. And I think that is the reason why CFA is here today. And we're stronger than we've ever been, despite the fact that we're challenged with resources.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that because it gives us all an understanding of how one can survive the next 30 years. We'll move on to the next question. What is Trump's agenda from your perspective for Africa, and has it been successful?
Well, you know, Trump has not been good for Africa. You know, he started out calling the African countries, I don't know about concurs on your station, but he called them shithole countries. You know,
we'll allow
and then time. He locked out a lot of African countries from getting visas to the United States, including Nigeria, Tanzania, you know, big countries. In other words, they don't mean nothing to us, you know. And there's just been a wholesale Africa program. And I'm not biased. I'm a Democrat by vote. but I don't operate as a Democrat. I'm not an operative of the Democratic Party or nothing like that. In the case of Africa, we work with whoever works on Africa, and your political persuasion is not that important to me. You know, if you ask me, we've actually done better under some of the Republican regimes than we have under the Democrat regime. The best president that we've ever had on Africa since I've been in Washington was George W. Bush. And when Bush came to office, he could not even find Africa on a map. But he turned out $15 billion for PEPFAR. He had another $5 billion for the Millennium Challenge account. He did a very good job with the goal with the trade bill. He was very hospitable to African leaders coming to Washington. He had the strongest Africa team at the State Department since I've been in Washington, bar none. Jindai Frazier was Assistant Secretary. Colin Powell was Secretary of State. You know, we had full access over there, and these were not just black people who were sitting in the chair. These were people who had really, very weighty thinkers. And
if I could add what you just said, I hear all the time from our Continental readers on Facebook, and they say that all the time. They always say good things about George Bush.
Well, they have no other reason to. I mean, he didn't know Africa, but he hired people who did. And he gave mm-hmm. them the apparatus to implement strong programs in Africa. Obama did well, but Obama came in, the country was bankrupt. And so Obama had to spend his first year or so, trying to, save jobs in America and welcome to the White House, and everything was in turmoil. And so Obama sent one of his envoys to see me and asked me what could he do to support Africa, given the fact that the U.S. was in dire financial straits and he needed to buy some time to get the U.S. economy going before he could do things in Africa. In addition, he followed George W. Bush. And so the Africans were used to George W. Bush when Obama came in, and they were, we got the black guy here. Now we know we're really going to roll, but Obama didn't have the wherewithal. So I gave him a paper, and I suggested that, one, that he didn't focus his attention on Mugabe and Biya and Bashir, these old guys, focus on the young ones coming up. And that idea grew into what is now known as the Young African Leaders Initiative, YALI, which was probably the one of the most successful programs.
Can we get to that later? Because I want to really speak about that, because we do work with some YALI leaders. We move on to that, can we go back to what is Trump's agenda? Does he have an agenda, and has it been successful?
Well, he doesn't have an agenda. There's nothing that I can say that this administration has taken on. We heard about Prosper Africa, but I can't even to this day, I can't tell you what it is. And I work on Africa, 24 hours a day. I can't tell
exactly.
you what it is. The first lady went to Africa. The first
one
went to Africa, and I was asked, could we help set her agenda? And I said, sure. I mean, I work with her on the agenda, but there were no follow up. So she goes in and wears funny clothes and goes see the animals and nothing, and no follow up. I can't say one thing that grew out of that. Trump, of course, hasn't visited Africa, but I don't hold that against him. He hired the assistant secretary, Tibor Nagy, who's a nice guy, but he doesn't. He hasn't done anything. I've always wanted the assistant secretary job to be a black person, a person of color. And we succeeded ever since George Bush was the assistant secretary. So maybe five or six. Out of the last six or seven assistant secretaries for Africa, there was only one white, Walter Kansteiner, during the Bush administration. And I basically had to, they even told me, look, the Secretary of State is black, so don't worry about the Assistant Secretary for Africa. I got that. You gave me the Secretary of State. How can I argue about his assistant being a non-black? But all the other assistant secretaries have been black until this time. Sure enough, we see it.
Let me get that clear. You said the Assistant Secretary for Africa right now is non-black.
Non-black, yeah.
And this is the first time in many administrations.
At least six administrations. We only had one in that period, and that was Walter Kansteiner, who was Assistant Secretary for George Bush, and that was when Colin Powell was Secretary of State. Condi Rice was national security advisor.
So he was so I guess you're saying only during the Bush years was there a white person overseeing or a non-black person overseeing Africa, but his boss was black.
Yeah, his boss was black. So his boss, his bosses were black. So I couldn't really make that argument. So I look at what you know what Trump has done. There's been some good movement. He did a pretty good job on Sudan. You know, transition from the dictatorial Bashir regime. To you know, I think a real positive regime that is now in place in Sudan. I have to credit the Trump administration with that. They held elections in the Democratic Republic of Congo that didn't result in war. A lot of us thinking that that was going to definitely be a war and a lot of death and dying and all that, and it didn't happen. And I think the Trump administration gets credit for you know the negotiation that took place. And, you know, some people say it was fixed and all kinds of other things, and it may have been. When you get to the Congo, you're talking about diamonds and oil and coltan and that kind of stuff. But nevertheless, you have to give the administration its props. But, you know, so you got a two or three. I think they're on the right side on Cameroon. You know, they really would want to see transition occur in Cameroon, and I know they're pressing for it to happen. So I give them credit for you know, at least trying to do the right thing in Cameroon. But there's so many areas that are neglected. And we're just seeing now Mali had the coup d'etat. But, you know, that was a result of the leftover war on terror in Afghanistan and Iraq and Syria. And so the combatants, you know, when they were getting defeated by the U.S. forces, went through the Sahara Desert. They went south. And then on the way, you know, Libya, of course, fell in the overthrow of Gaddafi, and the U.S. Supported that, but we did not secure the weapons to his massive military stock. And so those military arms end up in the arms of these rebels and these terrorists, and now are terrorizing all the Sahelian states, Mali and Chad and Burkina Faso and Niger. And more attention,
okay,
you know. And
before we go too far off of that, let me bring up Libya, or at least ask you more about Libya, because oftentimes on Facebook, our readers, especially those on the continent, when they do praise George Bush, they have issues with Obama on two issues, gay rights and on killing Gaddafi. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, when you really think about the Obama presidency, they were fighting two. When he came to the White House, we were fighting two wars. We were fighting a war in Iraq and a war in Afghanistan. We had like 100,000 troops deployed. Might have been more than that, but a large number of American troops were at risk. They were stuck in this war, and of course, he was trying to find a way to get us out of these wars and end these wars and get us into some kind of a pattern of you know governance for these countries. But along the way came the Arab Spring. And all of this talk about democracy and the young people were all coming up in the streets. They came up in Egypt. They came up in a lot of these Arab countries, and they wanted to overthrow these aristocratic, tyrannical leaders that they have. And so they succeeded in some of these countries. Egypt was the first one, and then Libya became a target. And, of course, we supported that. And so Gaddafi was overthrown, and, you know, we supported that. And then you had forces out there that see Libya in terms of oil. And, of course, that you know, they wanted to get control of Libya's oil supplies. So I don't think that the Obama administration handled Libya well, but they were handling all kinds of things, you know. It was almost chaos. And so, you know, you're not going to be able to fix everything in the Arab Spring. We didn't know what we were up against, you know. The young people were absolutely in the street. You could tell that the anger was pent up over, you know, decades. And they lacked jobs. They lacked adequate educational opportunity, training. And so they took it out on, you know, some of these presidents, these Arab presidents who have been in power 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. And so Gaddafi fell into that category. And I think he was assisted by other countries outside of Libya, you know, to make it happen. So, you know, I mean, you can't say, you know, in any one situation, you can't say any one president did everything right, you know. because it's you know, they're dealing with the world. They're not just dealing with any one country. Sure, they got some of them right, and sure, they got some of them wrong.
Okay, I think he even apologized for or said that the Libya issue was his worst one. Is that correct? Because I don't know if I got that correct or not.
I heard something like that, and I don't remember exactly what transpired. But, you know, I can say that, you know, it came in the time when we were trying to disengage from, you know, the Middle East conflict. And so you have momentum going in all kinds of directions. And, you know, I think in hindsight, maybe we should have handled it different. If anything, we should have secured those military stockpiles. You know, if we did nothing else, we should have made sure that Gaddafi's, you know, military assets were secured. And we didn't do that. All we were concerned about was taking out the terrorists in Afghanistan and Iraq and didn't care where they went. Well, they did go places. They went south. They went south across the Sahara Desert, and they destabilized these countries. So when these countries that were being destabilized needed help, you know, they saw this was coming. They were being attacked, especially the northern parts of these countries. And so they were asking for U.S. support, Western Europe, you know, European support to build schools, build health clinics, train people, you know, give these people something to live for. Because you had all this poverty in the north, and the young people, you give them $5, they'd rather to join the terrorists, Al-Qaeda or something. And so these countries were trying gallantly to combat these attacks. And but they asked the U.S. for support, and the support wasn't forthcoming. When Trump came to office, they asked him for support. They asked the Trump administration for support, and Trump sent out his arms guys saying, okay, why don't you buy U.S. weapons and fight them, you know? So make America great, buy American weapons, you know? And so about what happened.
And let me get back to the social issue. So should Obama have pushed the social issue, including LGBT rights, or did he handle that well?
I can't speak to that one. That's out of my ballywick, you know.
Okay.
You know, you got personal opinions about that. But a lot of the social issues that we fight over here on a regular basis, sometimes they play out differently in Africa and other parts of the world. You know, in Africa, the issue of gay and you know, lesbians and this kind of thing, many of these countries are structured in a real conservative fashion, real hierarchical, where you got this patriarchal system where the man is running things, and the man might have, you know, two wives or three wives and 10 girlfriends, but that's okay. But let the woman do anything that is perceived as free, and all of a sudden we got a problem, you know. And so many of the African countries themselves have been going through a lot of transformation around some of these social issues, around women's rights. And I can say that the women's movement in Africa has gained a lot of steam. And I think it's going to continue to gain steam. You know, I hear about things all the time.
Okay. So, you know, there are 54 different countries in Africa. So I'm going to ask you about what the agenda should be for each and every country. But as a whole, what is at least one important U.S. policy you would like us to ask the candidates, the presidential candidates, about, and that we as people who are concerned about the continent should be pushing?
Well, the you know, as far as the diaspora is concerned, and those of us who are Americans of African descent, the first order of business I want to talk to them about is, what is the role of diaspora in your strategy? I mean, what, you know, what role do we play in your policy toward Africa? And, you know, I mean, yeah, I see racism. You know, America is built on racism. And for those who think that it's a Republican or right wing, the only ones who don't like black people, you're fooling yourself. You know, the racism bites you whether you're left or the right. We've been, you know, black people in this country have suffered. It doesn't matter whether it's Republican, Democrat, or whatever. You know, we did not fare any better because of it. So the policy toward Africa, the same thing. What I'm seeing right now with Joe Biden's administration, they're jockeying already for these top positions. You know, that's going on right now. You know, who's going to be the Assistant Secretary for Africa? Who's going to be the deputy? Who's going to be this? Who's going to be that? And a lot of these white folks that I know very well are already jockeying for the job in this next administration. Some of them are calling me up and asking me for a letter and asking me for support. you know, and I genuinely I step away from it, you know, because I'm non-political. But I know they're asking, and they're not just asking for any reason. They're asking because they want to be a player in this next administration. I guarantee you, once they get into those jobs, they're going to be acting just like they have in the past, and we get nothing out of it. Our policies are not, you know, policies don't concern us, and major decisions don't concern us. The ones who end up doing the business in Africa are not us. You know, it's business as usual. And that doesn't matter whether it's a Democrat or a Republican. So I think the one question I would initially jump on would be the role of diaspora. I would also want to talk about the new African Continental Free Trade Agreement. Africans are you know, forging a market in Africa that would be one of the largest in the world. And that would put all 54 countries in one economic block. And it's something that should have happened a long time ago. It's something that Kwame Nkrumah envisioned and many of the others, you know, they envisioned it. But for many reasons, the former colonial powers, United States and many of these other countries did not want any unity in Africa. They're much better off, these countries being small and impotent and unable to support themselves, so they can easily go in and really take the diamonds, take the gold, take the minerals, you know, impoverish the people. That's what has been happening, really, for the last 100 years or so. And so, you know, we Africa's trying to invest to overcome this stuff. And we as a diaspora ought to be very supportive. And the role that we have to play is to lobby our own government to make sure we're supportive of the Continental Free Trade Agreement.
Gotcha. So can we spend the last 4 minutes, I guess, talking about the Young African Leaders Initiative? You spoke about that earlier. And to remind people, what you said is that the Obama administration asked you for your opinion on what they could add to Africa, and you suggested that they work with the youth. Personally, that's one of the things that put out on them, work with youth, and we do have some YALI members, YALI graduates who work with us. So when you explain the program to people and in the short and in a nutshell what the program is about?
Yeah, the YALI program, actually they identified, really it's been 10,000 of them over the course of the YALI program up until this past year due to coronavirus. But these are young people who have been identified largely by the U.S. embassies in these African countries. And they're brought to the United States for 6 weeks of empowerment and training. And, they had campuses around the country. Howard University had one. All over the country where they would be fanned out, depending on their interests, whether they were agriculture or environmental or city management or whatever. Each place had a different, focus. And so the 10 weeks in the United States, they met with all kinds of opinion makers and decision makers. They learned how things are done over here technically. They built alliances. But the biggest thing that happened with the YALI is that the Senegalese met the Kenyan, and the one from Swaziland met a Nigerian. And these young people are bonded, you know. Now, I tried to also push the State Department to expand this to the diaspora, you know, because I saw this YALI program 10 years from now. These are going to be people going to be running the countries. They're going to be running all kinds of things. Well, I wanted this to be a pan-African, you know, a birth of a pan-African sort of entity that, you know, young, because one of my argument was that African-American, these are the most dynamic young people you ever want to encounter. And I can say that I met tens of thousands of them over the course of the program. I haven't met one that I wasn't impressed with. And so
let me insert the ones I've met. They're usually much more advanced than people in general. But what I love most about the program is that it creates a network of young African leaders, and they talk to each other. And that's number one.
They talk to each other.
Yeah. It gives them a chance to know each other.
That's critical. But I think we ought to also push. I did it for 1 year. I got them to do a diaspora summit that we brought 100 of the YALI and 100 from the diaspora, and it was great. But they decided that the powers that be decided that they didn't really want this kind of interaction. They did not want these Africans to know African Americans who might also be dynamic. They didn't want it. And they want to be in the middle of the discussion, you know. And so those are the kind of things I continue to advocate for, and I will continue going forward.
So I guess you're saying the program, we only got 30 seconds left, but you're generally saying that the program itself are Africans that talk to Africans, but not necessarily Africans that talk with Africans in other parts of the African world.
That's right, especially African-Americans. They just, it's something about, that happened with the Peace Corps, it happened with other programs.
Okay,
too.
Well,
it's
I'm
one
sorry,
of the battles
we've got
that we
to go. PorterHarlem.net is the webpage. Like us on Facebook. Thanks so much, Melvin. The show will be on our Facebook page and on our webpage. Thanks so much, Melvin.
Thank you very much.
Okay. So, everyone, thanks so much for listening to Port of Harlem Talk.
Why don't they talk to each other? Come on, let's talk. Let's talk to each other.
Oh, thank you. I'm going to keep the cup. I'll keep it. Thank you.